Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival podcast. I am your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, September 29th, 2019. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 377. I have a super special guest, comedian and writer Allison Leiby, who currently writes for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon. You can check that out. Seasons 1 and 2 out now. Season 3 comes out in December. So I'm going to share that conversation with you in a bit. Right now, I'm sitting here in my apartment. I have put Power on pause. I'm maybe a third of the way through the latest episode. If you guys aren't watching this on demand, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know why you're waiting till late at night to watch this stuff. If you're a fan of the Showtime shows like The Affair and on the Kirsten Dunst show, I always mess the title up, On Becoming God in Central Florida, something like that. It's a good show. You can watch these things on demand. The only thing that I watch currently on Sundays that I believe is not on demand is The Righteous Gemstones, but nevertheless, so I'm going to get back into that. I'm going to record this intro. I'm going to be brief. I'm not going to fuck around too much, because I had a long and wonderful conversation with Allison, and I think that's more important than me blabbing about shit. But I will say that I have NFL Countdown on mute, and right before I put it on mute, Rex Ryan was talking shit about Baker Mayfield, and it was pretty funny, because they really did sice the Browns this offseason, and we're going to see what's happening. We're going to see, Young. We're going to see the Browns and the Ravens go against each other. Lamar Jackson is doing his thing, and we'll see what happens. I think you know who I'm rooting for. Pause for effect. So yeah, because Baker Mayfield was talking shit about Rex Ryan, and then Rex Ryan came back at him. So that was funny. He's like, "You're not making your reads. A Pop Warner guy could do that." I was like, "Oh shit." So I don't even know why. I'm happy that I'm awake and alive, and I'm happy that I'm vertical. But I had a really fun weekend opening for my buddy Paul Verzi. What a fucking great weekend. My first weekend, official weekend opening for somebody at Gotham. I commemorated it. And I talk about this a little bit. It's kind of been a theme this week about, you know, bombing inexpensive sneakers. And I posed the question to some folks on to Twitter and Facebook, and I got some really funny responses. Shout out to comedian Julia Rossi, who's married to another comedian, Will Miles. Will Miles, friend of the podcast, one of the producers and writers on Southside on Comedy Central, and then production and writing on Sherman Showcase. Both really funny shows. And I know Will likes to wear nice sneakers and stuff too, but it's funny that I'm going to find the tweet, cause Julia had like shouted him out, and I was like, wow, that's hilarious. Let me find it. Oh my goodness. You know, I didn't know that I would. Yeah. Okay. Here we go. So I just tweeted comics. Have you ever bombed in expensive sneakers? And Julia, who is Will's wife's very funny comic, Julia Rossi, she says, statistically, I'm guessing at Mr. Will Miles has, because obviously she's married to him and she's seen him a bunch of times. And I wrote back, I can believe it, because Will has a lot of cool sneakers. and Will writes back numerous times. It was just funny to me. It's fucking funny. Look at that feed. It's on my Twitter feed. And Gordon Baker Bone has a really good story, too. And I would suggest if you're a comic and you're listening to this show, find that. It's from currently, as I'm recording this now, it's from 3 days ago. And if you have a story, talk about the time you bombed. What I did and what Gordon did, I talked about the time that I bombed last year in September in some Kobe ADs, the Kobe last year's sneakers, which I really loved. And I did this show in, oh man, it's not really officially upstate New York. It's like, it's not far from that outlet mall that's up there near like Cornwall somewhere. I forget the name of that fucking outlet, but it's not that far from there. And it was like this club connected to a bowling alley. And it was, I was opening for some magician and I went up cold because it was just like a two-hander. And the guy, the owner went up and it was like supposed to be a fundraiser and they made me donate to the fundraiser. And it was just a weird night. It was all these older people and the power went out and I had to still try to recover from that. And I just didn't do well. It just wasn't a good set. They didn't care. They didn't give a shit about anything I had to say. And then they called my manager and they said, well, he wasn't good. I was like, look, the power went out and it was just a weird fucking, it's weird. It was fucking weird. And that club doesn't exist anymore. But nevertheless, I bombed in some Kobe's. And then fast forward a few months later, New Year's Eve, I destroyed in them. New Year's Eve in Saratoga Springs. So you never know. It can happen. So I was a little apprehensive this weekend. I wore my Jordan 12s. And actually, on this episode, you can hear me have to stop the podcast because the UPS guy comes and delivered them to me. I got them off the sneakers app. It's the third pair of Jordans that I had. I had a pair of Jordan 4s when I was like 9 or 10. And then after that, I never really had any. I had those like the Jordan brand sneakers, which I actually really did like. And I wore them all the time. I had them in college and I wore them a bunch of times. And then it got to the point I used to cut grass in them and stuff. I never understood how people, I guess those people are just cooler than me, but there's guys that wear Jordans to work. Like if they're working at the gas station or they're working at the movies, or they wear like fly ass sneakers to work. I never got that. Now comics, I guess we're working on stage and stuff, but like when you're doing like laboring jobs, I don't know. Can you guys weigh in on that? Please email me, tweet at me. I never got that. Like if you're doing like, I get like if you worked at Foot Locker and stuff, I get it. You have to be fly, but like, do you have to be like fly like that if you're working in the warehouse? Because I did those jobs. Like I wore boots and stuff, or if I had to stand on my feet all day, I did. Because you would crease. I don't know. People still talk about the creases and stuff too. Like when you're at work, you don't want to, like I was working at Best Buy. I think you could just wear like black sneakers or I don't know what it was, but I think I wore like New Balances. I think I wore just comfortable shoes. They weren't like, it wasn't like fly shit. It was just, I wore nice shoes and stuff, but I mean, I have a little bit of style, but I wasn't wearing, and around that time I wasn't really going hard in sneakers. Like theater people, most theater nerds and geeks, the people in my circle, like they didn't really go wear shoes like that. Even the black people, I don't think it was a thing. It just wasn't a thing. I don't know. I wore casual shoes like the Penguins, I can't think of the names, but like, I don't know. It was just never fly shit. That always fascinated me. You know, I wouldn't want any, if I worked at a gas station, I was pumping gas. I just wouldn't want to mess the sneakers up. And if I worked in a movie theater, like if I was a young kid, just when I was working, I never would want to crease the shoes. You just kind of want to wear them when you're going out or something. But I don't know. I'm not that cool, so who gives a shit? But that was a little fun thing I think about. But if you have a story, what I did was I found a picture on like StockX and I posted the shoe, and then like they'll have like whatever the price is now and you know, like what it's selling for at the time and all that stuff and blah, blah, blah. And that's pretty fun. And I think Gordon Baker Bone has the best story. So just look on my Twitter feed and find it. I think it's pretty funny. Because a lot of times everybody talks about, I fucking killed, I fucking destroyed, man. Everything was great. Like nobody ever talks about, people do, but they don't talk about it as much, like when they bomb and shit. So I thought that was funny. And Allison and I talked about it a little bit as well. I didn't see any movies this week. Joker's out this week. Super excited for that. So I will be seeing that hopefully twice if I can. I don't know, and I'll try to get someone on to talk about that, to nerd out about that with. Shows with Furzy, super fun. Always good to see that dude's act grow and everything. It's good to kind of be, when you have a friend that's doing stuff that's ahead of you in your career and it's in their your respective career, and get to watch that take off and on a like methodical pace. Like, you know, I've known Paul for about 7 years, a little over 7 years, and it's good to see that that growth and watch his new hour. And it's fucking great. Gotham's a great club. It was good to see other comics, and I fucking love it, man. I fucking love. I love showbiz. I love the New York comedy scene. I don't get the whole Civil War thing, to be quite honest with you. That's going on in the comedy. That's supposedly going on, and of course, a lot of comedians are making fun of it and whatnot. And yeah, it's just interesting. It's like I said it last week. There's no Civil War. It's fucking weird. The kindest people that I've met in show business have been a lot of comics. A lot of comedians have given me opportunities, given me times to work when I didn't have money, carried me, said, hey, do this gig. Like, they didn't know that I was broke or didn't have, you know, enough money, but they would say, hey, can you do this weekend opening for this guy? And you get a little bread and able to sustain your living, to sustain your life by doing some gigs and what you love to do. So a lot more than the acting world, I would say, the theater world. But people have been, there are some really kind people. And I know how they say never meet your heroes, but like quite a few people that I respect and comedy that I grew up watching have been super nice. And the first time I mentioned this before, and it's a broken record by now, but I will mention it again. First time I got on stage at Caroline's, one of the best clubs in the city, was through D.L. Hughley, you know, doing guest spots. He didn't know me from Adam, but I met him at Levity after a show, reached out, said, hey, could you ever open for him or whatever? And so, yeah, do some guest spots. Take the bullet at the beginning of the show. And I did it, and it was fucking awesome. And he took me out to dinner with him and his crew, and I had sea bass for the first and only time. It was delicious, and it was fun. It's a good time. So that's an example of it, you know? It's quite a few others, so I don't know what people talk. I think they're just, that's the media trying to make a big deal out of things. Watch SNL. Some really funny sketches. Good to see like Maya Rudolph. That, you know, I bitched and moaned and yelled and went on a mini rant or whatever the hell I did last week. And I fucking feel bad for Shane Gillis, man. It's like, fuck, man. There's a fumble in the red zone, fumbling on the one. And like I said, I might have said it last week, it's just like this real insidious thing that's going on where people try to take stuff away. And, you know, I'm not a fan of racism. I don't know what's in that dude's heart, but the comic in me, the human in me was just like, fuck, man, that dude could have been on that fucking show. You know? But just try. We all got to do better. That's an example of everybody. We can all do better. But I'd be lying to you if I was. I'm not glad that dude's not working there, and I don't even know the guy. But so it goes. I think that's it. That's it for me blabbing. Let's get you to Allison. So Allison, we talk about when we met, but I've known of her for quite some time. Never really got to have had some pleasant interactions with her, but never got to like sit down and really shoot the shit and talk to her. Recently found out that she was from Maryland, so that was fun to talk to her about. And there's a couple moments, we did this over the phone, there were a couple of moments that maybe you can hear like a slight echo of sorts, but nothing that, and we fix it towards the end, the latter half of the conversation. And I think that's it. There's a new Patreon episode upload that I just uploaded like 10 minutes ago as I'm recording this. And I think that's it, folks. Just enjoy my conversation with Allison Leiby and yours truly. I'm just going to start now. Sometimes I cut the phone off. I mean, I cut the phone off. Sometimes I cut the AC off. But if it gets too hot for you, don't.
It's totally fine. It's been blasting all day. So I think I could take an hour to like not have it just like on high.
Okay. Don't kill yourself for this show. Like if it was like Rogan or I don't know, Marin or something, maybe, but not this one. If it was
I could probably bear to have my electric bill go down by a couple dollars, so I have no problem with that.
Oh my god, mine was a couple hundred. God,
this year was pretty brutal.
Yeah,
I feel like I worked from home or was like off for like a week or two in the middle of the summer when it was like 97 every day. And I was like, well, I can't just sit in my house and sweat. Like,
yeah,
I have to have my AC on and then all of a sudden I get my bill. And I'm like, okay, well, you paid for that.
Now you see why your parents were like, cut the air off or cut.
Yeah,
exactly. Why they're frugal about stuff. But when it's really hot, it's like, I don't care. Like,
especially at night.
Yes.
Like I can't go to bed in my apartment and have my apartment be just like sweltering. It just is not happening.
Yeah. Do you have roommates?
No, it's just me. I have a little one bedroom in Brooklyn.
I love it.
It's basically a studio with an extra wall in it, but it works for me.
so you're like a real adult. No roommates?
Technically.
Hold on a second. Okay, we were talking about the AC. I ordered some sneakers that I shouldn't have ordered from Nike. And I knew that, I was like, oh, I thought they'd be here when I got here, so I wouldn't have to worry about it. And then I forgot to tell you, I might have to get a UPS
order. A problem.
Yeah, so.
I order a lot of things, so I understand that plight.
Do you ever? And so I got a pair of Jordans, and I didn't have that many when I was a kid. Not because, I guess I had one pair, but I've never been like much of a sneaker guy. But my listeners know that I like sneakers and shit like that. I'm not too crazy, but I posed this question to people on social media today, and I asked if they'd ever bombed in like nice sneakers, like expensive sneakers.
Oh, I'm sure that people have.
They said that one of my friends said, haven't you seen some of these Netflix specials? I was like, wow. I was like, I wasn't even taking it there. I was just thinking something that like maybe you bombed at a bar show in Brooklyn or something. Have you ever had like an outfit on? I don't know how much probably not in the sneaker culture.
I'm not a sneaker person.
But women love shoes.
I feel like shoes in general are really tough for me to like want to invest in because
really?
Walking around the city I'm just on my feet so much that they just get so beat up.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm a lady, I'm like a handbag gal. I'll spend a lot of money on a bag. Okay. But I don't see, I wear the same thing almost every time I do stand up at this point. Not even intentionally, but just like in the last 3 or 4 years, as I get older, I just care less and less. And I'm like, like, not that I think I look like crap, but like I'm wearing more and more just like plain sweater, pair of jeans, pair of, you know, loafers or whatever. Sure. And that's like my uniform all day, every day, regardless of what I'm doing. So
yeah.
Then it just absorbs all the bombs.
I understand that. Like, for me, my uniform is jeans, sneakers, and a polo shirt. Like,
yeah.
I mean, whatever makes you feel better on stage. But have you ever had it like a show or something that you're like, I'm going to look good in this shit tonight? And like,
yeah, I definitely have dressed up more for, like, in the past more. Like, uh-huh. I feel like nowadays, you know, it's all kind of the same, but like in the past, especially when it felt like some shows were higher stakes or more important. Whereas now I'm just like, well, it's not TV, so I guess I don't have to wear makeup.
Sure. Yeah.
But there are definitely, I remember doing a show at this like private club that kind of like, I guess it's the private club in the city. It's kind of like the Soho House.
Yes, I've heard of
the one where Anthony Scaramucci belongs.
Okay.
In Midtown. He wasn't there, but it was like it was a club where he was a member, to give you like some context.
Gotcha.
And it was like just obviously like a rich, stylish group. And I just remember looking into my closet being like, you got to figure something out. And it was still just a version of what I wear every day. But like,
sure.
Slapped on some eyeliner and just kind of like wore more of my jewelry or whatever. And it was just such a brutal show. Like, I just couldn't get... It was right after a Weinstein had gotten, you know, uncovered in the Times.
And
all of his accusations came out. So, sure. Like, they were just... It just felt like every rich person in New York was really tense.
What's going to happen?
Everybody's like, am I next? I remember being like, oh, I thought I looked nice, and it didn't matter because the show was so bad.
That's the thing. Like, that's what it is. Like, I was thinking about that. Like, because I when I was a kid, I had a pair of Jordans, and it was based on an achievement. Like, my dad said, like, I have a bit about it, but my dad said that if I got my black belt in karate, I could get a pair of Jordans, which was like, it's like achievement based.
Yes.
And
like, I'm big on achievement-based purchases.
Yeah. And so, like, I bought those same Jordans for, like, I guess whenever the hell I figure out on when I'm going to record my first comedy album. So, like, I would do that. And these, like, this weekend I was thinking about wearing these shoes that I just bought because it'll be my first full weekend working at Gotham, like opening for somebody.
Oh, that's great.
So it's like, it's kind of like, it's in my head, like, even because like Jordan would make up stuff. Like he was a psycho. So he'd make up stuff like, I'm doing this because these guys, like, I have to have like a goal and all this crap. But anyway,
I do the same thing. Whenever I get a job that feels like a cool, exciting job, I buy myself a present.
Exactly.
Be like, you did it. You got that job. You earned it.
Yes.
I didn't do that yet for Maisel. I haven't bought myself something, and I've been, you know, circling some very expensive things that I'm debating just kind of pulling the trigger on, which is very scary.
Now, congratulations. Are you working on season 3?
We just finished season 3.
So you're doing season 4.
Yeah, so season four, we just wrapped season 3 like 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
And then season 4 will start at, you know, hopefully I go back. I'm assuming I will, but who knows, you know, can't count on anything.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't start until after the new year, so I'm kind of coasting for now, but I never bought myself a present for getting season 3, so I feel like I need to do it retroactively.
I feel connected to you even more on one level, one superficial level that we'll get into. But even now, just like maybe 5 minutes into this conversation, where I kind of feel like I have to do that. Like when I get if I get on a show, I book a part, and I feel like, yeah, some of this, most of it's going to a bill, but there has to be you know,
some
like,
of it has to be for something for you, like, especially because I feel like with what we do with comedy and like with writing and acting, like,
yeah,
it's such a slog for so many years where you don't have any money for yourself,
right?
Because, well, 1 second, somebody's buzzing my
sure, door. Sure. Are you good?
Yeah. They're just gonna leave it downstairs.
Okay, cool. Do you want to go get it?
No, I don't. I don't even think it's for me. I think they were buzzing all the apartments.
Okay. Your place is safe where they won't like take anything.
Oh yeah, there's only like, 3 people that live in this building, so I'll notice if somebody takes something of mine.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you have to get yourself something when you. Yeah, I totally agree.
It's just that there's so many. Excuse me, I had to walk away. There's just so many years where you're just putting all of your money into just getting to do this, and like I just remember spending money to do open mics, to losing money on road gigs, like you know, like not getting to do fun things because I was like trying to write or go to open mics or go to bar shit, you know, like you make so many sacrifices for what is a very long time. I mean, like for me, it was like 5 or 6 years before I started making like real money from this.
Right.
So like when I did start making money that didn't have to just purely go to me surviving and like I was making a paycheck that was like, oh, this is enough to like have something fun happen with it. And God, it's been years since I've had that, you know, I decided I had to start, buying myself things, you know, and then I just like opened the floodgates and I'm like, ah, shit, now I'm just buying so much stuff.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel better about like, I'll buy my parents something too. You know, like I'll buy them a little something or get them something from Amazon and then, you know, pay some bills off or get ahead of some. And then like I think that's healthy. Now I feel like it's healthy because you do it.
Yeah, it's always spending always can easily be justified if someone else is spending.
and you that's true. And you also live alone and I live alone, too.
Yeah, that was like a very important move for me to make.
Yeah, when did you make that move?
I guess it was like 5 years ago. Okay. I was living in I had a roommate and I had a creative day job at the time. I like had a copywriting job at Comedy Central. So it wasn't like, oh my God, I have a TV job, but like it was a good job.
Yeah.
And I had had roommates for years and I was finally just like at the end of my rope with that whole lifestyle. And I was like, you know what? I make barely enough to do this. I'm going to live alone.
Yeah.
But then like I've had roommate, like I like when I went out to LA for a year, I had a roommate because I was just kind of like not really working and was just kind of seeing what LA was like. And then I came back and was living alone. And that, so, but I've been alone for a while now. I can't really do the shared apartment thing.
Yeah, I think I've lived alone since, God, do you count college at all? Or do you count, like, when you were out of school?
Out of school. Because in college, I kind of, like, lived in, like, big houses with other 22-year-olds. So, it's like, you know.
So, I would say then 23 for me. So, like, when after my first year in grad school, I would say 23. Like, and I had my own apartment. So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My parents helped, but like they told me to get a job. Like when I was out in Chicago and they said, oh, if you get a job, we'll help you out. And then, so I had
I think that's a good deal.
Yeah, it's great. And like, I got 2 jobs. So I got one that was like a full time and another like was a part time job at Best Buy.
That's great.
Yeah. So that was like, so they knew I meant business.
Yeah. I've always, you know, and I've been lucky too. And that like, you know, early on, my parents certainly were like, as long as you're making money, we can help and we can help supplement you.
Yes.
We'll do that, which is great. And like, I understand the privilege in that. And
I'm
always very grateful that I had it. But like, for me, like a living situation has always been something that needed to be like pretty like locked down and decent, you know. I'm a little envious of friends of mine who have been able to be like, oh, well, like for 2 years, I just lived with like 7 other people out like 15 minutes from the end of the L train. And like, they're like, so I have no expenses and can just do whatever I want. And I'm like, that's so great. And I've always had like a full-time job so that I could have like an apartment that was, you know, near the subway or in a nice area or alone or whatever.
Yeah.
it's just, you know, people have different priorities, and I'm envious of people who can just more easily be like, yeah, I can live here. But I definitely can't.
I think you're right. I think there is a privilege in it. And then at the same time, you have to break down the facade of people making it because of just because they lived in squalor and they suffered.
Right.
And because the business and in any field you pursue, and, you know, we're talking about artistic fields, that's going to be brutal. So when you lay your head down, you want to at least have some comfort from the brutality.
You don't really like, especially, and like personally as a woman, you know, and going out and doing open mics and shows until, you know, 1-2 in the morning sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially those early years when those open mics would end, you know, they'd start at midnight and you're still sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be like, oh, and now I have to walk into a dangerous area.
Yeah.
That like was, you know, or come home to a building that's like scary and there's some people there I don't trust, you know, I, you know, it's a problem with being a woman, and like, I wish it wasn't, but it is.
Well, yeah. See, that's the thing. Like, it's almost like, I don't know if I was going to bring that up, but since you did,
right.
Like, it's almost because my producer told me that I needed to be more diverse and have more women on that's me, by the way. But it's sort of like how I think even I was listening to Ron Funches.
Uh-huh.
I was listening to his podcast a couple days ago, and he was saying, yeah, you know, it feels weird to ask you what it's like to be a woman in comedy, but at the same time, people bring that up, and it's not I want to know. Like, I want to know.
It's also a different question when it comes from someone within comedy, because it's like,
true.
Well, you know the baseline of what we're talking about,
yeah.
And you're looking for some actual differences as opposed to like a random interviewer from morning news who's like, so what's it like? Do you meet a lot of guys? You're like, what? what are you talking about?
So did you start here? Did you start in the city, in New York City?
Yeah, I started in New York. I had been living in New York. I moved here like pretty shortly after college and had some other jobs in creative fields and didn't really know about pursuing comedy or if I would or that it was even an option.
Uh-huh.
So I was like living here for like 5 years probably before I even started doing any comedy whatsoever.
And when did you move here?
It was like 2006.
Okay.
It was right after I graduated. So I had a couple of years of pre-2008 New York, which was quite a different New York than we have now. Especially, and I wasn't doing comedy, so I was just like out and around with my like friends who we would just go out and party, and it's very different now.
Yeah.
The wheels really came off when the crash happened.
Right.
There's not still 9 million mega rich people running around like a playground. But anyway. But then it was like I was probably 27 when I moved here when I was like 23, and I was probably 27 when I started doing I was doing some storytelling open mics,
sure.
And then started doing some stand up open mics when I had a little bit more confidence, because I had never performed in any way.
What rooms were you doing? What rooms were you performing in with the storytelling?
Well, I had done a little storytelling class with Kevin Allison, who is incredible, and he runs Risk, and I was a fan of his from The State from a million years ago.
Sure.
And so he like kind of taught us, because I had like one story from my life that I really was like, I think I want to write about this, but I don't know if I want to like sit down and write a personal essay. Like, I feel like it's a live story to tell. And so I took a class and did it. And I would go to the Moth every once in a while. And then there were some other little storytelling shows around town, like remember the Fifth Estate? Remember that bar in Park Slope they used to do stand up to?
I've heard of it, but I don't think I've ever done anything there.
Feels like it's from a million years ago. I'm sure it still exists, but I've definitely not been there in maybe 9 years.
sure.
But I would do the Moth. I would do shows like at the Pit and kind of little shows around. And then I just like the joke telling elements of telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like the part I like is the funny parts, not like the drama or the lessons or anything, which are interesting to listen to, but it's not my favorite. And so then I just started like going to as many open mics as I could find.
Yeah.
And like that old, I remember there was like that website that was like a calendar that just had like a list of like every open mic every night of, in the city. And I would just check boxes and just run around town and go to all of them.
For Bad Slava? Is it Bad Slava?
Bad Slava, that's right. I was trying to remember what it was called and was like, I was like, what is it? Starts with a B.
Yeah, that, did you ever do Parkside Lounge?
Oh, yeah. Loved listening to that Parkside mic. There was like the Saturday at 3 and Sunday at 4. And
yeah.
And there were some evening ones. And God, there were some. I would do like some of the I would do like New York Comedy Club and a lot of the ones like the late night Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or something Monday, Tuesday at the Pit that like started at 11 and you were doing 2 minutes and it was just brutal.
Yeah. Some of those were just kind of, yeah, that I've done the Pit maybe a couple times. I would do Ochi's. That was a main one. And it just seemed like after that, I think I've said it before on the show, but just it seemed like after Ochi, after Comics closed.
Yeah.
It was like, it was really sad.
Yeah. That was rough.
Yeah.
I remember doing, I did a lot. There was like 2 or 3 years where I was at the Creek a lot. Which,
yeah.
Oof. Different time.
it was brutal. And you know, like I think about like all the, I went on a mini rant about last week because I did the episode by myself and I went on rant about like how, you know, we talk about like some of these comics think that it's the end of the world when, you know, about the Shane Gillis thing. And it's like, yeah, you could say whatever you want, but people have the right to not accept it, or you could get fired or anything like that. Right. I mean, I think it sucks and all that stuff. And I also think it's insidious to do that digging to a certain, it's something that's like really mean spirited about it. Just as the person could be saying something racist. It just doesn't look good on all sides, but
yeah, it's a pretty gross element of just the world we're living in now in terms of both, you know, the positives of pushing forward, like having, you know, more representation and having like more people's voices heard and more people's voices respected. But at the same time, like this gross digital age where people feel like they have to constantly be putting stuff out there. And some of that is bad. And it's just like it's a reality that like I'm like, God, I long for the days of like even 6 years ago. It didn't feel quite like this.
Yeah, because it's just like when you said about looking nice at that club and doing a show and people felt. Like, I think a lot of people, a lot of comics feel nervous about the shoe dropping on them. Like, what did I say on my podcast?
Right, exactly.
I mean, you could, like,
I think it's good to have, like, some, you know, it's nice to be like, wait, so we need to be accountable. This isn't just a stream of consciousness, even if it's unintentionally hurtful.
Yeah.
It is good to remind people, like, you are being recorded, and it is. Someone can find it, and like that, then it's not, you know, not up to you if someone's offended by it.
I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, one of them, Vag with Adrian Appalucci and Sarah Tolomash.
Oh, they're both so funny,
and they were talking about. They said like this is the episode that's out like right now this week, their latest episode, and they were talking about we got to get somebody to dig in our podcast to find bad stuff, and they kept and they were talking, and as they were talking about not getting canceled, they were saying things that could get them canceled, and it was just like, oh my God, I think they know what they're doing. But
yeah, those two, I think, have good heads on their shoulders about those things.
Yeah, so they're so funny. And but what I was thinking about as I was thinking about that those open mics, it was just a cesspool. I don't know what it's like now, but it was just a cesspool of like this angry, like a lot of angry white dudes. And I'm not trying to, that's just what it was. And I'm not trying to bat. It's not everybody, but I just noticed one of the things that pulled me out of it was just like, I'll just do bar shows and work on stuff there for paid gigs. Because it was just not, I didn't find it productive.
It really, I mean, there was especially some years there and some very specific venues and places that I think drew in more of the same people.
Mm-hmm.
where like I'd be sitting in a room and look around and I'd be like, I am the only person in this room who's not a straight white guy. I mean, not even like, you know, just not setting all of those boxes. And it would get called out and it would like the guys would comment on it when they were on stage and it felt gross. And I was just like, do you do this at a show? No, of course not. Cause no show is populated exclusively by, you know, people that look like they were almost school shooters, you know, and it's, which is why I think like there is such a, and this is all just me like theorizing about like a group of people I'm not a part of, but
yeah,
I feel like most of the bitterness about making it or not making it or getting things came from straight white men. And I feel like it was in part because they so oversaturated the open mics and they all had such similar styles and things they talked about, and not everybody, but of course, like, you know, there's a homogeneity to what was happening, that it's that, like, you know, it's those people that become the kings of the open mics and then they're like, well, where's my Netflix special or my late night set? And it's like, but you don't perform for anybody, but like you only know your world. And like, you know, being a woman or a black man or anybody else of color or LGBTQ, like it's like we've all been performing for people who already don't get us at open mics for so long that like we've learned to like adapt and move around. Whereas like I feel so many straight white men who were pretty like rigid in like what they thought their voice was.
Yeah.
We're just hearing it echoed back and they were like, oh, so like these guys think I'm funny. And it's like, yeah, but those guys can't buy tickets to shows because they don't have jobs.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it was just like
an echo chamber.
Yeah, it was weird. And that's why I think that's why you have to be around, to make yourself a more well-rounded person, you have to be around people that are different from you and then have different experiences and then take that material and travel, like to see how it works. And even like I think we're fortunate because we live in this area, in the tri-state area, where you can make a lot of that stuff happen. And you can go to like Central New Jersey and do a show. You could go to Westport, Connecticut and try that material. Yeah, so it's
you only have to go like 10 or 15 minutes outside of the city to have a totally different audience.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's the thing that, and so you were moving through, because I feel like I met you, maybe the first time I met you was on your, I want to say it might have been 2014 or 2013.
Yeah,
on,
maybe
at the,
I try
at UCB
and remember
East.
When I meet people, and it's always so hard because it's the years have really blurred.
I know. I feel like it was like when
UCB
I was
UCB East feels right. For a few years I was there constantly too. So even if it wasn't whatever show we're thinking of, it was another one.
Like, I think it was. It's a Long Story, possibly.
Yeah, that sounds right. When I was running it with Andrew, maybe, or maybe it was just me.
I think it was just you. I think it was just you, because it was like it was cool. Because I mean, I did it recently.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know what it is about the city, but for some reason, the best shows seem to be. I seem to have the most.
Oh, sorry. Oh. Hold on. There's a massive fire engine passing.
Oh, geez. Okay. I was wondering. I was like, what is that? The apocalypse?
And.
Okay, it's all good.
Okay.
Oh, I've done shows with worse situations than that.
I live on Atlantic Avenue and it's very busy.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's what a shit show.
Yeah. But
how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that every day?
I've kind of gotten used to it. And like, again, weirdly, like maybe this is personal preference. I think it's a little bit shaded by just being a woman who lives in the city, is I just do objectively feel safer when I'm on a very busy street.
That's understandable. Yeah.
As opposed to like those real quiet, when I used to live on the Upper West Side, even those real quiet residential blocks, which are, you know, it's obviously a nice area, but I didn't like there not being people out on the streets and there, you know, there weren't businesses that were open very late. And at least on Atlantic, like it's noisy, but I don't feel scared coming home.
I can see that
late at night.
Yeah. Because there's always somebody around.
Yeah, there's always some people around. There's always the bodegas on the corners are all open. There's guys across, you know, you're kind of just like people are seeing me going in and out. And if something happened, I feel like people would notice. But maybe not, you know.
Well, I I totally get it. I get it. What were we talking about before the fire truck?
Sorry. So you were saying something about shows in New York because you had just done my story show recently, yes. like a month or two ago. But yeah. then you had done it. That's I do think you're right, and that we did that. It was probably like in the early days of that show at UCB East.
Yeah. It sucks that place is gone.
It makes me sad, and I know people have a million issues with that room and with UCB as a business.
Yeah.
And I understand all of those, and I share those, mm-hmm. but. That room was like, once you really figured out how to play that room and once you could really fill that room with people, they were always a great crowd. And it was just kind of like a fun clubhousey vibe that yeah. I missed.
It's like a good, it's a good mix. Cause it's like, it was just like, you had people that are there to see a show and have a good time. It's a little, even though like one of the things that they don't pay the performers, I get yeah. it. And then at the same time, it's like, we're doing something that we would do for free, but you can still work on stuff. So
yeah,
you're not losing out even though, but it's like we as artists, we sometimes have to bite that bullet, but
yeah. And like, look, if I was somebody who had a lot of paid spots being offered that were good, I yeah. probably would have taken them. But like that really, you know, and maybe that's, you know, another problem where like the shows that do pay are, you know, clubs that don't always book like fun, more up and coming younger people. So then you're mm-hmm. forced into this world where you're doing these great shows, but yeah. you're not earning any money, but you are getting better and it is fun.
Yeah.
And again, I'm saying, I always felt very conflicted in that argument because I think you're similar, always had a job and always had some money coming in.
Yeah.
Whereas if I was depending on stand-up for all of my money, like, I probably would have a different view of how okay I think that was.
So I want to get your – okay, so put a pin in that. I like that you went there. What I was also going to say, and I don't know how you feel about it creatively, but I feel like some of my best experiences in New York City – doing stand-up or like those late shows.
Oh yeah,
it's something about that energy where it's like, yeah, the show's at what time is your show, like 11?
My show would start at 11:30.
And
on a Saturday, which is very yeah. different than a Friday, 11:30 is a brutal experience
because everybody's drunk,
yeah, and everybody, like, you know, has been working all week,
yeah,
the audiences, so like they're drunk and they're tired,
mm-hmm.
but Saturday most people get a later start, so 11:30 is just kind of like the middle of their evening.
And now that you mention that, I think the Friday late shows, like doing a weekend at a club, is just kind of like, you never know what you're gonna get. Yeah, like you never know, but you can always like kind of, you can expect the worst.
Yes, exactly. Saturday is usually a more fun,
yeah,
even if it's later, even if they're more drunk sometimes, like it's not as like, I don't know. There's that weird like marathon vibe to a late mm-hmm. Saturday or late Friday where it's like people like worked all week. They left work. They went to happy hour drinks. They went to dinner. They had more drinks. Now they're at the show. They've been up since 7:30. And you're like, oh, I don't want that person in the audience.
Yeah, because the show.
I wouldn't want to be that person in the audience. I would want to be at home.
Right, because your show, like that one dude went long. I don't think he was taping something for NPR or something.
Oh yeah,
but that one, right. That guy went long. But other than that, like,
oh, God. Yeah.
that show was like that. Those audience members, like, they were there to have a good time and they were fun.
Yeah,
you know?
They're fun. They're listening, even when it's a smaller crowd. It's still always kind of like a good vibe.
Yeah,
and they're kind of like down for whatever people are going to bring to them, and they'll mm-hmm. laugh if it's funny, and if it's not, they won't. And that's every audience. So,
how do you feel about the new venue? How do you feel about? What do you think about subculture?
I'm loving subculture. I do miss the, like I said, like the clubhouse vibe that UCB yeah. really had, where like I was pals with all the bartenders because the bartenders were other UCB performers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was kind of gross and kind of dirty, but like definitely just had a fun hangout to it.
Yeah.
But subculture feels like the more grown up version, and the staff is so lovely. The room mm-hmm. is so beautiful. it's a bigger room to fill. And it's, so it definitely, you know, if you have a small crowd, it feels more noticeable, but yeah. At the same time, like, that's a room that was objectively built for sound. Yeah. 'Cause it's like mostly a music venue. And I think, like, you know, if you have 20 people in that room versus 20 people at UCB East, like, it might kind of be better. It doesn't feel like that long, dark hallway that goes into nothingness the way that UCB sometimes could.
It can't. Yeah, that's true.
So it's a wider room, but it is bigger. You know, and Robert Dean and I run If You Build It on Sundays, which is just a fun stand-up show that we share. And you've done it, right?
It's been a long time.
We got to get you on. We just got a new booker, and we refreshed the list that had not been refreshed in a while. So stay tuned. We will have you on because it's so fun.
Definitely, because I did it trying
to build it into like a nice hang, because like it's a nice bar, it's really accessible, like it's right near the subways, and the way like UCB was a few blocks out. So
what do you call that neighborhood?
I think it's technically NoHo.
Okay.
I think it's like, because it's like north, it's not quite, I mean, it's like, I guess that's the East Village, but it's the kind of western side of the East Village, but it's still North Soho.
Because I remember, like, leaving that night. I was like, why the hell am I on the FDR? I felt like I should have been on the West Side Highway going back to Jersey.
Yeah, it is further east, because it's east of Broadway.
Okay.
So it's, like, kind of that weird, it's that weird area. You know, there's those neighborhoods in the city where you're like, this isn't not a neighborhood, but it's actually not a neighborhood.
Yeah, it was like, I was like, what is, I do like that show. I like your, it's a long story,
I started by doing storytelling, and like it informed how I do a lot of my jokes, and like I'm not necessarily like a long, like true story person in my stand-up anymore, but like I think that all stand-ups are good at it, and like so many of us like aren't gonna take the time during like a regular stand-up set to be like, I'm just gonna talk about one thing for 8 minutes of this. So the show is just like so people can do that, which is so fun. I also just like hearing about all my like comedy friends' lives that I don't know about.
yeah. Well, see, this is what I want you to talk about. I want you to talk about like having a day job. Because I feel like there's there's been this wall around like this myth of where like, oh, you don't care about your craft if you have a day job, or you dedicate your whole life and you have to be poor. And I feel like in my experience, it's because I had a day job that I was able to make some of the road gigs, or like get a hotel, or like just to be able to do shows, is because I had a little bit of money, you know?
I have always felt the same, and I understand that everybody's in a different position financially and has a different, you know, floor for like how low they'll let their finances get or what. And like, I grew up upper middle class, in Maryland, which we still need to talk about.
Yes, we do.
But like, you know, I grew up comfortably, and like, I certainly like, you know, down to, you know, drink the cheapest beer and eat dollar pizza sometimes when I absolutely have to. But like, you know, I never really believed in that idea either, that like you have to be like a poor struggling artist for you to be a real artist.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I made any compromises when I had a day job. You can't really do stand up between 9 and 5.
Yeah.
And like, you know, people are like, it's a safety net. And I'm like, yeah, I want a safety net, because if something happens to me and I don't have one, like, I want to be able to go to the doctor if I get sick or hurt so that I can then come back and keep doing stand up.
Right.
But again, like, it is like making those road dates. It's like being able to, you know, there are times that I've gone away on a writing retreat with some friends that like was very inexpensive, but like definitely spent like $100 or $200 to like go somewhere and sit and write for a whole weekend. And like, I wanted to always be able to do those things. And I also do believe like in it, being out in the world is where most of our material comes from. And
yeah.
Interacting with people who are different than, like, if you, like I said earlier about the open mics, like if you're only ever hanging out with comics and then going to open mics and then going to shows, like, I just don't know how relatable your life is to people who come to a comedy show because they want to see a comedy show that night.
Right.
So for me personally, like, having an office job always gave me like some material that the people in the crowd are going to relate to because they're people that also were working at office jobs of various.
That's my material, like my chunk that usually kills the hardest. And, yeah. And like when you're talking about money and like worrying about money and like all that stuff, because it's something that it's the people that pay to get a babysitter that are
right.
coming to see you. And like, I don't know how that got ingrained in me, but I know I watched my parents get up and do like labor-based jobs. Uh-huh. And like my dad had two of them and my mother worked. And so it's just sort of like, they worked until they couldn't do it anymore. And so I always saw them work. And it's like, if you work, you can get this stuff, or you can provide for yourself. And you see it. And I had a friend in LA. Yeah. I had a friend who's a comic in LA. He said, yeah, there's people in LA that lie about their day jobs. Like, what? Like,
I wish it wasn't so stigmatized, and I don't know where the, like, you have to be struggling, you have to dedicate everything to this one thing became kind of the script that everybody is running off of for how you become successful and how you consider yourself a real artist.
Yeah.
And like, there's people who are like, that's selling out. And I'm like, good. I eventually want to sell out. I am in this because I believe I am funny and I like making funny things, but I'm also in it for one day that I have like more money.
Like, right.
Like I'm still, and like, it made me treat comedy more like a job because I had a job.
Yes.
So I knew how much I didn't like what I was doing. You know, I just had some various office jobs and stuff like that for the first few years I was doing stand-up. And I obviously was unhappy there. And I'd been doing other jobs that I wasn't fully thrilled with before I started doing comedy. So, like, I personally felt like I really wanted to take advantage of the time that I was spending on comedy. And I was going to sit down and write. And I was going to, you know, yeah, I could hang out after this open mic and drink beers, but I could also go get in one more open mic and still be home at 11.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do that because tonight's my night to do open mics, because tomorrow I don't have to get up as, like, it just makes you, like, the compartmentalization, you know, it's the whole thing where it's like, if I have one thing to do, I'm never going to get it done. But if I have 10 things to do, I'm going to do all of them.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's true. I mean, I don't know. Like, I just feel like some kind of way about it. I feel like it's almost like I kind of have a chip on my shoulder about that, where it's like, well, dude, if you didn't do anything all day and I've worked and then I've had to spend all day out, haven't been up since 4:30, and I'm doing laps around you on this show.
Right.
And so what's your excuse?
I have felt extremely the same way, and it's hard because you can't really articulate it, and it feels unfair that the other side gets. I feel like there were many times that mostly men, but women, you know, whatever, just comics would make, like, you know, I'd show up in like business casual clothes to an open mic because I had just been working from 8 to 5. And it's like, oh, like just like a lot of like little side jabs and comments and jokes. And it's like, I'm fine with that, but it sucks that I can't really say that back to you. Mm-hmm.
You can't say peasant.
Yeah, right. How was not having dinner last night? Like, that's a terrible thing to say. And I don't relish.
Oh, no.
I would never relish that idea about anybody. And I would obviously never, ever, ever feel that way. But like, you can't make the do like the kind of like edgy joke back to somebody about that. And it's, you know, because of how we all talk about money and think about money in this country. But it always was like a tricky thing where I'm like, man, I'm busting my ass doing multiple jobs and then like picking up freelance writing jobs. And, you know, I'm happy now it really all worked out for me personally.
Yeah.
Not that like, if you do those things, it always works out. But like, I feel like I'm like, yeah, that like hard work did pay off, and I don't have any imposter syndrome or, guilt about having the jobs that I've had in the last few years, because I'm like, I know I worked really, really hard, and I know that like no one can really disagree with that.
That's true. I think one of the coolest things that my parents are, in general, they're proud of me and all that good stuff. But they and that helps a lot when you feel like when you're going through this by yourself and nobody's really gonna pat you on the back. But it's sort of like my parents said, yeah, ever since you were 15, you always worked, like you always had a job. And I think that's value to them. I mean, to me too, that's valuable and everything. And it's, you know, so that's one thing that I can kind of carry with me. But I think definitely, like, you have to support yourself, and you have to
be an adult.
Yeah. Like, it's so funny. Like, I get what people like that term adulting. It's like, yeah, that's what you fucking do.
Yeah, because at some point you do have to grow up and be like, all right, bills are real. And and you also start, like, I mean, realizing that, like, you know, when you're 19 or 18, like, for the most part, I mean, some people probably have had their eyes open to, like, what this means based on their, like, family or life situation. But, like, you don't understand what losing a job and not working for a few months means financially. You don't know what a house fire or a massive medical bill, or like, you don't really comprehend what an emergency will look like financially for you. And like, the older you get, the more aware of what that is. Mm-hmm. And the more you need to really make space and make the time and be like, I do need to make sure that I have that. Because if something happens to, and I've had a bunch of back surgeries and been kind of like not working at times because I couldn't, but, and like, even then I was still kind of on the young side, and still I, you know, had jobs that had lots of protections in them and insurance situations and also my parents, but starting to be like, oh, I have to take cabs everywhere for the next 4 weeks. I can't ride the subway.
Yeah.
That means I need cab money extra. Like, you know, I think the older you get, the more you understand what those things are, and the more it's time to just kind of like pony up and get a job so that you don't, you know, get stuck. And you don't want to be a burden. I don't want to be a burden on other people and be like, oh no, I need help. And I'm so glad that, like, I mean, people do help others when they need it. Like, we see all those GoFundMes and all those scary, you know, something happens and people turn out, and that's great. But, you know, nobody wants to be that person.
Right. Yeah.
You don't want to need, you know, you don't want to have to ask for the help. You should want to, you know. And also, that's when, like, the government should really step in and be like, you know what, we need socialized medicine and we need some kind of base income for everybody and all those things. I'm on board with all of that. But that's not our reality, unfortunately.
Now, since we're talking about real shit, I would say even like some of one of the best things in life that happened to me, like, now that you said what you just said, it feels like one of the biggest adult moments in my life was, like, probably one of them was getting a car. It's just like a used car, and my that's parents huge. They didn't have to sign it over. Like, they didn't, my dad didn't have to co-sign.
Yeah. That you just was, went in and got a car by yourself.
That was one thing.
That's huge.
So, like, and then, like, fast forward, I mean, that car got totaled, fast forward to this past summer, where I'm picking my coworker up that carpools with me, and my car won't move.
Oh God.
So it was in her driveway, and she had to go to work. Like, she caught the bus and went to work. I got my car towed, and I had to, like, anytime you take your car to the dealership, it's at least $500.
Oh, just for showing up.
Yeah. So I was like, fuck, this is horrible. And I said, well, I'm not missing anymore. I missed 2 days of work, and I said, I'm not missing anymore. I had to get a rental car, and I didn't have to ask my parents.
It feels good to, like, I mean, in the moment it doesn't feel good.
No, it doesn't.
You know, you're like, this is the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
But, like, it does feel good to, like, be in those, you know, have a big bill, have a crisis, have a large purchase that you need to do, and be able to just be like, okay, I can do this. I am just gonna take care of it myself because I'm an adult now and that's what I do.
Yeah. Now I should have. Now I we started the conversation with me buying shoes that I shouldn't have bought. The those Jordans I could have paid on the credit card bill, but I was like, you know what? That's the, what do you call it? You're a writer. That's the what is it? It's not irony, is it? Is it?
No.
Like, yeah, I'm an adult. I'm making these big decisions, and I'm doing.
And you're still, yeah, and then you're still like spending money that you
that
shouldn't
I shouldn't
spend.
Be spending. What is
that's
that?
Part of being an adult, though, is choosing how you spend your money.
It's part of being human, too. Part of being flawed.
Also, I mean, you know, we all have the worst case scenario nightmares in our minds for like what could happen at any point. And like, you know, some of me is just like, I don't know, if it's a couple $100 and it's something I just want so bad and can't stop thinking about, if I can do it, if I can swing it.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather get those shoes, get that bag, get something that I really enjoy and like, get time to enjoy it. And like, what's the worst case scenario? Like, I got to pick up an extra job or I can't go out to the next, you know, one of the dinners I want. It's like, that's okay. Like, you get to choose what you enjoy.
And it's like, now I really got to try to book this audition tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe you're just like subconsciously putting the pressure on yourself for the next job.
Some of it's like, I talked to this guy, I did this pilot last year. And one of the lead guy on the show was like, yeah, you know, it's good. He said, yeah, it's good that you have a job. You have to, you don't want to walk into an audition desperate because they could smell it on you.
It's true.
Yeah. And it's
also having a job makes you in the same, like, I'm sure for acting, it's very similar to also comedy and like, you're good at the professional, regular socializing side of this that has to happen. There goes another siren.
That's fine.
You know, it's like, let me just let it go for a second. Atlantic. Okay, I think it's fast. But like having a job, especially a job that you're not like passionate about or don't know, you know, where you're like, yeah, it's a job, so I make my money. You're with people who definitely aren't the same type of creative that you than you are probably.
Right.
Like it does force you to learn how to do all of the small talk and the politeness and the professional, not that people don't know that stuff inherently and by being in the world, but being in a job kind of makes you sharper at it. And like, I just remember going in for interviews for the first time, like when I was first interviewing for like big TV jobs.
Yeah.
And I was like, God, I'm so glad I've been on a bunch of job interviews before.
Yeah.
And that like,
yeah.
And that I've been working in an office and know how to like, behave. Not that other people don't. It's not saying like comics that don't work, but like
it has
those wheels are greased. Like you're in that zone,
right?
And so that's just something you don't have to think about because you're doing it automatically,
and it helps you connect. Like even with my job now, like I would rather be on set somewhere, but I take pride in that shit. Like because like I was talking to my boss today. And I was like, hey, you know, we're like, we have I work in insurance and we have like a company that handles like our, how do I say it? I'm trying to make sure. Like that handles like our rate structure and everything. It's like a system that virtual benefits administrator that basically, and like they handle all that stuff. And so we're trying to do like some new coding and stuff. And I'm like, hey, like I'm trying to make sure this is right. And they told me one thing. It looks like they want something else. And I told my boss, I was like, well, can you look at it and talk to the, and she was saying, yeah. And I said, well, you wrote back that email. That's exactly what I wanted to say. So now I'm not going to worry about that anymore. I'm going to let you guys handle it. And then you run it down the flagpole to me and I'll fix it like you guys want it to be fixed. But yeah, it's just like I'm concerned about that shit.
Right.
You know,
and it's like good to like learn to care about things that aren't just because like I've learned now I've had like a couple of writing jobs and like a couple of TV shows and all different ones. And you start to learn that like, or I've at least started to learn that like, they're also just jobs too.
Yeah.
That's true. Like, you know, I've showed up at some of these and I'm just like, oh my God, this is going to be, and you're like, and then like you're a month or two in and you're like, oh, okay. Like this thing annoyed me today. Like you're going to be annoyed. You're going to have things you don't want to do. You're going to have to talk to people that you don't want to talk to. And like, that's a job. Cause at the end of the day, this is just a career. It's just a job. You know, it's an exciting one, an amazing one, and one that we work so hard to be able to get to do, but it is at the end of the day, a job.
Yeah, like, that's true.
And being prepared to like learn that, like, I feel like it was a lot less of a letdown because I was like, oh, I understand how to do this.
Cause I noticed like, I've even been, you know, how you see somebody on stage, you're like, this person isn't trying hard. This shit is hack. I see people at my job. It's called, me and somebody else called people. Oh, they just sit there and turn on Excel. They don't do shit. And it's true. Like they're not fucking doing anything. It's like they're just they're just collecting a check. What the fuck is that guy? You know. But
exactly.
What I wanted to. So I think we touched on that. I think you made me feel better about some of my life choices. That's basically what this show is about. Making me feel better about my life. No, it's not. What I wanted to talk to you about also was like. Writing. So you're currently with the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Emmy Award winning show, Golden Globe winning show.
Yeah.
Can you talk about you did, what was the first big job? Was it the President show?
President show was the first like full time big job. Okay. Before President show, I had a couple of little 3 months on an E show and like, you know, plenty of MTV stuff that everybody
speak on that a little bit. Cause is that kind of like the farm system in a way, or is it like non-union-y type stuff?
Yeah. Those non-union job, a friend of mine, we always call them garbage jobs, even though they're very much not garbage and they're much better than, you know, the day jobs that we didn't want to do anymore.
Sure.
But they are kind of like, they're not even, it's a lot of, I did a lot of pilots that I worked on. So like that's 3 weeks or 2 months or, you know, somewhere in between, you know, it's not long-term enough. They're not union. So you're not like getting your insurance and all of that. Like, you know, but you are kind of like, it's that first step to like, okay, so this is how you make TV of some kind.
And you're learning, right?
And it's like, and I learned a lot at those and, I think there some people don't end up doing them, like they just are lucky that like when the job finally comes through, it's for a big show that's up and running and not a little rinky dink organization. But, you know, because the garbage jobs in quotes, like, you know, working for E or MTV or VH1 and you have, you know, very little budget, no insurance, no. You know, no oversight. It's barely going to go on TV. It's probably just going to go to digital, you know, those things. But, so I did a handful of those. And then got, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog.
Oh, wow.
Which was the first like thing that I thought was super cool. Cause I grew up thinking Triumph was just as funny as it could be.
Now, was that with CISO? What was that with? What
that
network?
That was with Hulu.
Hulu.
But it was,
okay.
But it was like before Hulu even did original programming.
Gotcha.
So there were these like a couple of what were specials that were centered around the 2016 run up to the election. So like the conventions.
Yeah.
So they were kind of like event based, project based. I was doing it kind of like at night after I had been working at my copywriting job all day. And I was like, is this what TV is? Do I still have to have a day job when I'm working in TV?
Yeah.
But that was very cool, but it was very, you know, it was very short and it was just kind of those events and then it was over. And then, you know, and then it was a year of submitting for every job I could find, you know, every job my agents could get me up for and getting so close on so many and it was a whole year of nothing. It was brutal. I, you know, everybody's always like, you get so many jobs. And I'm like, you know, there was a year I did like 40 packets.
Wow.
And it made me better. And like, then eventually when I like got a packet for the President show, which was a show that I genuinely enjoyed and I knew Anthony and loved the show. But I knew how to do it and I knew what to do. And that was the first big union full time, you know, more than 2 or 3 months job that I got. So I was there. And then from there, I went to the opposition after the president show got canceled. And then the president show, and then the opposition got canceled, but then the president show had a special. So I jumped back over to that.
So the opposition, how long did the opposition go for?
The opposition aired for about, I think it was a little bit under a year.
Okay.
I was there for like 6 months, I think. Cause I had been at the president show for that, those 6 months of the end of that show. And then I went and closed out for a while. I was telling my agents, I was like, I'm television poison. Only put me on things that like, I can't like that you guys think should be canceled. Cause I just felt like every time I showed up at a show, it got canceled.
Okay.
But, which I mean, those were like amazing jobs with great staffs. And I met so many cool writers that I wasn't close with before that now are writing partners of mine, and we kind of work on pilots or we'll
yeah.
work together ideas, and you know, that's how all of it works. And now I'm kind of, I see that now, because it's not just stand up. There's great people from improv and sketch and people who have been just writers and come through other avenues and kind of all end up making these shows together.
Now, how did you get your agent? How does that happen?
I had been out and doing stand up for maybe 5+ years at that point, and I had a man, and then had gotten one like garbage job at that point. I did like 3 months on a show on E.
Okay.
It was just kind of like a pop culture-y show.
Yeah.
That I wrote for, and then that was in LA, and I moved back to New York, and there was a manager I had known who had been like kind of like flirting with, you know, signing me, and eventually he signed me just because like he had known me for years, he knew my stand-up, he knew I could write, and it looked like, oh, and she can get jobs, like that's great.
Yeah.
And now she's got this one under her belt, so that's a lot easier moving forward. And then he kind of started contacting different agents and sending them samples of mine, and they would come to shows, and there, I guess there were a couple in the mix, but when I would do packets at that point, when I didn't have an agent, sometimes my agents that my current, or not current, because I had to fire them, but
oh, why'd you have to fire them?
Oh, because like the Writers Guild and the agencies are all in this like big fight.
Oh,
like,
yeah, right.
Everybody
gotcha.
Fired, not
right.
just me.
Gotcha.
But my agents that I ended up signing with, like, were kind of, you know, they would put in a good word for me or talk to the showrunners for shows I had submitted packets for,
mm-hmm.
and Triumph was the one that made that, because like I guess Robert Smigel was like, she's so good, I gotta get her, how are you, like, and they signed me off of getting that job.
Okay. That's so cool.
Yeah, so and they were, and I liked working with my agents. I had a really nice relationship with them, and I thought that they always did right by me. But you know, the overall issue between the Writers Guild and the talent agencies is messy, and I think we are right to be firing them, and there needs to be a new solution.
Has there been any resolution to it?
No, I think it's like worse than ever.
Jesus.
I think it seemed I thought maybe it would be a couple of months and then they would all come to the table and the mm-hmm. union and the organizations would find some kind of compromise, but
yeah,
it seems like we're further away from that, and the more people I talk to, the more people think like that this may be kind of like the new normal, and that it might be a year or 2 years, or, you know, who knows.
Jesus.
How long.
Wow.
So it's a different world, but you know, I'm happy to not pay 10%. So
yeah, get that money. Keep that money coming in. Yeah.
Right, I got to buy more handbags.
Oh, I thought that was resolved. That sucks, but it's good to be in a union. Like, it's good. Like, because that your path reminds me of a lot of what I went through just as an actor, just am going through. Well, you're like, before I got in the union, and
yeah.
It was like, you're doing these MTV things and you're
yeah.
building your craft, and you're doing all these like commercial thingy spots and stuff. And then I remember even speaking to us, our conversation about like day jobs, when I got on my first SAG gig on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, the other actors were talking like, yeah, so what do you do for your survival job? And I was like, oh, shit. Oh, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a survival job.
Yeah. It's no need to have any like negativity towards it. It's like, oh, I do this, I do that. And I was like,
yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. You know, and I did like a little co-star part on a on like some movie a couple weeks ago, and I was I don't know what I don't know why people try to talk bad about day jobs. And I was like, yeah, I don't get it. That's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the tide is turning a little bit on it too. I think people more and more have day jobs than I think used to, at least in stand up. I feel like I sense more people have decided, and maybe just because everybody's a little bit older now, you know, mm-hmm. and have been like, oh, I can't just like have 12 roommates, and I can't tolerate, you know, walking dogs anymore. Like I want to be more more comfortable.
Yeah.
As you get older, you want to be more comfortable. That is just, you know, uses for sleeping on floors and staying up late. And I definitely did that myself, but
right.
You know, I don't want to do it anymore.
I want to talk a little more about like TV writing.
Yeah.
I want you to, and then I want to talk a little bit about Maryland and like where you grew up, and then we'll try to make this decent and wrap it up. I'm having fun talking to you, but I just want to.
No, me too. This is great.
I just want to make sure that I actually have structure. So yeah. it's me. It's not you. because when you talk about stuff, it makes me think about other like.
I know it's
portals.
So easy to veer off into other avenues and discussions.
So I want you to speak on the difference between like maybe writing for shows for like a guy, like one guy, like Anthony Atamniewicz.
Yeah. Like a late night.
Yeah. Who was my improv teacher.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. He was my level one improv teacher. And he kind of ushered me into stand up. I don't think he knows that, but I think like maybe I might have messaged him or something about it. But like, he was one of those teachers where there was like, you know, we're not going to do any bells and whistles. We're just going to try to make these scenes real, try to come on with something, you know, honest, and then play from there. Like play.
He guessed it.
Yeah. And not being afraid to fail. So that was a thing with him that I always appreciated. And
I've been so lucky, and I've never had a bad boss. I've always had great bosses and worked for really brilliant people. But Anthony, well, probably because he was my first like real big break thing. Like I just always will have a special sensitivity for him, because I just think he's so wonderful.
And thank you. I think maybe you and Ray Sani, right?
Oh yeah, me and Ray.
Yeah, but Ray was also on the show a couple years ago.
Oh great!
I think people get a mundane festival bump when they do this show.
Oh good.
They kind of their careers, they kind of take off. Now it hasn't happened for me, but for other people that have been on. But for everyone else, so I mean,
perfect.
Yeah, so you know, maybe in a month or two, maybe you'll. Who knows what's going to happen?
Who knows?
So, I just speak on like working with Anthony, working with Jordan, late night type of shows, and now working on a TV, a scripted TV series.
A narrative.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
talk
really
about that.
Different.
Mm-hmm.
I personally enjoy both of them. Mm-hmm. You know, late night has become even from what a couple years ago, it's become a very different thing. And the political climate has kind of forced everybody either to be like all politics all the time, or kind of this, we're turning a blind eye and we're just going to play fun and games. And I don't know which ones I've always been on the very politics heavy side.
Right.
But it did, those shows really, just because of where we were as a country and still are, they weighed on you a lot if you were working in that field. And I understand, like, it's still a comedy show. It's not like we were, like, actually at the border or actually, you know, out fighting. But, like,
the work still, you still have to do the job of making people laugh. Yeah.
You still have to sit and watch and read and think really heavily about some pretty dark stuff.
Right.
And there's so many, you know, a news story comes up and you're just sitting there and you're like, I don't think we can make that funny. I don't think that there's, and it's true, because so much of it, you know, if Trump does something stupid, fine, let's make fun of it. But like, there's nothing funny about the fact that we have an objectively horrible immigration policy right now. You know, they're inhumane. And like, And you would start, you know, I think like from when I started at the President Show or even at Triumph, which really was like my first political job, to when the opposition got canceled, there were more and more stories that surfaced that were just so deeply inherently not comedic that we couldn't really even, like there was a huge shooting multiple times on both of those shows that like had to be kind of addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, it's something I don't have to do in narrative, and you don't and like, I have, I mean, I used to have, you know, 50, like a special Twitter feed that was just all the politicians, all the pundits, all the news sources, all the crazy, like far right nightmares that, you know, especially for the opposition that we had to kind of be keeping an eye on. And a million emails every day with everything that was happening. And I would read everything, and it was, the news was on the background of my house at all times. And like, now that I'm not in that world anymore, I've very heavily unplugged, which I feel guilty about, because I also feel like, you know, my civic duty is to be more on top of these things. I was for so long, and I feel like information is important, but at the same time, it made me so deeply sad and depressed for so long,
right,
that I need like a little bit of space from that kind of barrage of, you know, sadness, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. Cause even now, don't you have to unplug in a certain way to write for Maisel?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, part of me misses those political jobs and those late night jobs, because you do, something happens that day or that week, and you put together, hopefully, like a sharp, incisive comedy piece, either a desk piece for Jordan or a field piece or a, you know, an Anthony, you know, bizarre sketch kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it would feel, you would feel a little bit that it was a little bit cathartic, because you would feel like you did something, and
right,
you would feel like you're helping, and you also just could feel like, even if no one sees it, even if nobody changes their mind or does anything because of it, you know, in your mind, like, I feel better just mentally and emotionally having like processed that from A to Z.
Yeah.
Whereas now, like, you know, I see something terrible and I'm like, well, now I just know that information. That's awful. you know, and you had the immediacy of like, I wrote this morning and it went on TV at 6 PM. Like,
that's amazing. Yeah.
And Maisel is such a long, you know, we started working this season in January, and we just wrapped the writing at the end of August, and I think that they finished shooting shortly after, and it comes out in early December, so like it's not a ton of time in post.
And then everybody's gonna watch them all in a day and ask for where's the next season.
Yeah, and where's the next, and like, and you're like, oh, things that I wrote in March that went into scripts that got shot like aren't getting seen by anybody until December, which is a really long time to have to wait. I can't imagine how people in film do it.
Yeah.
Because like TV, at least it's like within the year. Film could take years.
Yeah.
So there, you know, I miss the immediacy, and I miss the kind of like proactive feelings that I had about like what was happening in the country. But at the same time, like, it's fun to get to write for different voices, to build scenes, to write, just kind of for a variety of different people that can be jokey and vulnerable in a very different way. You know, I don't know, you know, how long will I stay at Maisel? Will I go to something else in narrative? Will I go back to late night? Is there some other thing that will like emerge as like a comedic form that I'm interested in? You know, it's hard to know. But it is, I do like kind of like putting together a story with a real beginning and end. And what's fun about Maisel that's so different than what the President Show and the Opposition and Triumph and all those other jobs had, is that like, it's real. I mean, it's a comedy, but it's also a drama. And there's real stakes and there's real emotion behind a lot of the characters. And it's, you know, I haven't written a ton of that, but I've gotten to kind of help do that a little bit. And it's been an interesting experience, and it's fun to write to that as well as writing like a very silly, you know, one-liner or response or stand-up joke for Midge or whatever. Like, it's nice to get to do both in one show. I think it's pretty rare.
Can you, and to that point of like pitching like jokes and stuff like that, maybe this is the same with both types of shows. Like, how has it helped your stand up in the way that, because I know I feel like sometimes as comics we can be married to our jokes and to our material, and then when you're in the arena of maybe six or seven other people in a room, in a writer's room, where it's like, no, that didn't work. What else you got?
Yeah.
Has that happened to you? And how do you deal with it?
I mean, especially, I feel like The Opposition in particular, because that show went on every night of the week. Mm-hmm. And so, it was, even if we did have just like a great, like, it's like, the show is great, but like, okay, at 9 a.m. tomorrow, we have another meeting because we have to make another show. Like,
yeah.
There was that, but like also both the President Show and The Opposition had very heavy improv background staffs.
Sure.
That, like, just because Anthony and Jordan are both improvisers, first and foremost, I think. So they brought on staffs of people that they trust and respect. And a lot of them were from the world of improv and not stand up. And watching, like, you know, some of these people with a more improv background be able to just constantly be like committing to bits and like riffing, and you know, I like riffing. I do a lot of crowd work. But there's a skill level difference where I'm just like deeply impressed by the creativity that some of them could use in the room. Whereas Maisel's more like, you know, we hem and haw over things, and it feels a little bit more like stand up.
Yeah.
I think because like there's such a set, like this is where each character is going by the end of the season, and this is kind of the scenes that they imagine for them. And so you're kind of more fine tuning in a way that felt more like stand up, whereas those nightly and weekly late night shows were more like, all right, let's put up something different tomorrow. And I'm like, we can't just do the same set. But I got this really good joke, and it's like, great. And now they saw that, so now you need another one. And it's like, wow, we really just have to keep making TV, huh?
Yeah, because Midge has, she doesn't seem to repeat her material.
She doesn't, and so it is fun. I think that we're trying to imply, I think, this season that she is learning that that's something that you do a little bit in stand-up.
Yeah.
And we've kind of written, but that happens more in the scene work with, you know, Susie, her manager, and
right.
the people around her, where she's kind of discussing how it works more, rather than we keep showing her do the same stuff.
Yeah.
But she's way more stream of consciousness, but like, you know, writing, you know, polishing some writing for someone to deliver a stream of consciousness is like a pretty big ask and a complicated.
Sure.
You're like, how do you write something that's going to be sharp and funny, but has to make it sound like it's probably off the cuff? In a way, like, whereas, like, we write stand-up for ourselves, and, like, yeah, the, like, conceit of stand-up is, like, maybe these people think that I'm making all of this up right now, but, like, the reality is everybody knows that stand-up is mostly written and refined over years.
Right.
So, like, you know, for me, it's, like, both shows have kind of forced me to loosen up a little bit on stage, like...
That's good.
Midge is loose. Right. Even though it's written, it's still loose, and her and Rachel's performance is loose, and it's kind of inspiring, and it got me to like rewatch a lot of old Joan Rivers, and I'm just like, oh, what an empowering, you know, comedian to watch, and so cool and interesting and like different from what I feel like I do, but also like within reach. Mm-hmm. So I think like for a while when I started writing I wasn't writing as much stand-up for me, because I was pretty emotionally and mentally spent writing all day. And sure. All of a sudden I'd be like, ooh, I don't know if I want to just sit down and write jokes tonight or go do three shows where I have to just kind of like fuck around. and now I feel like I've found that balance a little bit more. And like understand how to, you know, and at The Opposition and Present Show, like I definitely like, I did more political stuff on stage because I had so much left over from like the stuff that didn't make it to air that I'd be like, I can talk about this in a way that'll sound like me.
Yeah. You can't talk about being a housewife in the 50s on stage.
Right. Usually, yeah, there's not as much overlap in life for me and Midge, even though we're both like Jewish girls who live on the Upper West Side. You know, we have some similarities.
Yeah, I think and then at the same time, you're writing for Amy Sherman Palladino, who, like, the creator of Gilmore Girls, and those characters talk a lot. Like, they're very, like, loquacious. So you just, like, you're dealing with, like, and that's like a
fast pitch. Long. Scripts, when the finished scripts for Maisel are they look like movie scripts. They're very long.
Have you ever been on set and watched them film?
Yeah, a little bit. They did a lot of location stuff this season, which is really fun. But they were on the lot a bit. And I did pop down kind of just see it all in action, you know, when I could and when it made sense. And it is cool to see them work. Cause like Amy and Dan also direct. So you watch them go from like, I want this episode to be about this to like literally being on set, directing something that they've written. It's very inspiring.
That's great.
And just watching, you know, and just watching narrative get shot versus late night where you're just kind of like, all right, let's roll through this 30 minutes and then get out of here.
Yeah, it's
we have to do it again tomorrow and it has to be totally different and we're going to have to like write a whole new thing.
It's definitely an interesting process just from the actors end where it's like I remember one time my dad telling me I had like a 12-hour shoot. And it went into overtime and all that stuff. My dad said, "Oh, I guess it's not what you thought it would be, huh?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's better. It's so much better. Like, cause I don't mind you know what it seems like? Like if you do a day, like as a day player or a co-star or something, it's sort of like did you ever do theater in school, high school or college? Didn't.
No, okay. Never.
Well, you never. might not get the reference, but other nerds would. I think it's like Tech Week. When you're doing when you're doing Tech Week for a show, like the show's about to open and you're doing like you got the crew and everybody's there. Nobody really gives a shit about you as the actor. You're important, but you're not.
Right.
Like everybody it's almost like how my parents would say, "Yeah, we never worried about you going to college. We knew you were going to go. We just had to be concerned about how we were going to pay for it. But everything else is on you. You know what you're supposed to do." So it's kind of like that. Like you're in that realm, but it's at the same time you still have to be. You're waiting for them to light this thing. They got to light this thing, or they got to move the camera. So you get the fuck out of the way until we need you to be there. So it's kind of like that, and it's just like it's cool to see all these people that make this great stuff happen, you know.
And it's like a nice reminder. Sorry if that one's not too loud. Right.
Oh, you know what? I think I'm getting a slight echo.
All right, let me.
Can we do it without the speaker?
Yes.
Okay. I just don't want it to.
How's this? Better?
That's better. I can hear me echoing before, now I think I can. It's all good.
That's fine. I mean, this is perfectly comfortable. I talk on the phone a lot.
this isn't Patreon. They're not paying for this. It's still a good episode, but fuck them. They're not paying for this.
Right.
That's really shitty of me to say. Guys, I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean to say that. but it's one of those. It's definitely. I think like it's definitely more magical in theater and stuff and then live performance, like when we do stand up and improv and things like that. But it's like it's a different type of thing now, like where it's just like you're being behind the scene where they're trying to get this shot, this certain shot, and they're trying to do this creative thing. And then when you see it, it's like, oh, shit, that's, you know.
Yeah, it is cool to see how much goes into, you know, this 3-page scene. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden there's 20 lighting people and you're on this huge sound stage and there's all the stuff that's been built and you've got all these different cameras and they're all, it's just cool to see how it gets made. And like, I'm sure that novelty will wear off at some point. It hasn't yet, and it's still like going to set for anything still is fun and cool to me.
Well, that's good to hit. You know what? Let's stop it right there. Do you want it to go? I don't want it to go away from me.
No, but I'm sure over time it will.
You think so?
So maybe not. I mean, maybe on different jobs, but like in the same way that I feel like going in to write on a show every day has lost a little bit of the like where you're like, oh, okay, this is just the job.
I try. Like, I'm fighting that. You know, I'm fighting.
I don't want it to. I definitely don't want it to. But I understand how time passes, and I understand that like
of course.
I just want to enjoy it while it hasn't.
I feel because I feel like we're the same age, and I think we're about the same age. And I feel like the older you get, the more you can kind of lose sight of things that made you want to do what we're doing, and keeping that childlike passion and stuff for it. But like, I was even like, and I say sometimes I can be a little cheesy on the show, but I remember like doing your show, like your late night show.
Yeah.
There's to me, there's something about maybe it's because I live outside of the city and I get to see the sky. Like I get to cross the bridge while I'm driving and driving down the West Side Highway. But it's something about driving in the city at night, going to do a gig. It's the shit. And it's like, and you see people that, you know, maybe you've worked all week or something in your life has been going on. And then I see you, or then I see like another
right,
comedian,
another pal. Yeah.
Yeah, like somebody that's in the thick of it, like that's in working and doing it. It's something that's just like, you can't beat it.
Yeah, it's still so fun. I still, you know, I love, you know, in other interviews, I remember people are like, are you, and I'm like, I love what I do. I'm very aware of how lucky I am to get to do it. And like, I'm so glad I did it. And I'm so glad that this is like, it still is exciting. And there's going to be, you know, like maybe being on set or being in a writer's room will start to feel at, you know, less exciting in the next few years. But then there will be the jump where like, there's going to be a time when it's my show that I created, that
exactly.
I sold, and like, we're going to be making that pilot, or we're going to make shooting that series, or, you know, it's like, there's fun, you know, what's nice about entertainment is like for a while, is it takes so long to get to those points that you look at, you know, you know, I look at Veep and I'm just like, oh God, I wish that was my show. And I ran that. And it's like, okay, well like maybe in 20 years you will.
Yeah.
And you know, there's still a lot of things you can want even after you get in the initial doors that you think are the only thing you need.
Very much so. And normally the podcast would end there, but because I've been questioning you and we've been going down these different pathways like Pulp Fiction. I want to talk about Maryland. Now,
let's talk about Maryland. Let's close out on Maryland.
I had known you for a couple years and then like we were friends on Twitter and social media, but like you mentioned, I don't know what the hell it was that you mentioned something. I was like, do you remember?
I think I was on the Amtrak Regional 187 going back to, and I think I like I was just sitting. I remember being on the train when you messaged me because I was saying something about Maryland and I was tweeting about how I was in Delaware and then I was posting photos and videos of being on the stupid train.
Yeah.
And I remember you respond. You were like, "Wait, are you from Maryland?" And I was like, "Are you from Maryland?"
Yeah. I was like, "Oh shit." I was like, "Cause there's not that many." Like, there's like now comic. I don't consider like. There's comics that I know that are from D.C. and from the area.
Maryland is a different thing than D.C.
Like we would say where I'm from in P.G. County, we would say the area, like people that I know. Because even if you lived in Northern Virginia, I would still consider you like a homegirl or whatever. I would consider you somebody.
Yeah, the greater, like the Delmarva area.
So like, I know that there's a couple comics that are from the area and all that shit. But then when you met, I was like, what the fuck? I was like, oh, I didn't know that.
There aren't a ton from like Maryland proper.
Yeah.
There are people who are from DC and outside DC that, you know, it's close. You can connect on some things, but Maryland as a state, when you live just in Maryland, it's a real different place.
Now, because it's a, I mean, I don't know how, it's not the biggest state, but there's just a, there's still a, there's a lot to it.
There's a lot, like Maryland has Baltimore, and then it has like Baltimore County, which is so different than Baltimore. And yes. Baltimore is even different than DC.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have like Western and Southern Maryland and the Eastern Shore, which are all so rural.
Yeah.
But then you have like these giant sprawling, like suburban and like half city, like, you know, like Columbia and like places like that, where it's like, it's a suburb, but it's a giant suburb mm-hmm. of a big city. So like, it has all of these different types of places you could live and types of political views that you could
yeah.
have.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I find it to be like the most striated state in terms of just what's in it for how small it is.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also like, there's the beach right there. And like, you're still only like 3 hours from New York and, you know, but you're also 3 hours from like the middle of Appalachia.
there's a comic. I don't know if you know him. There's a comic named Lafayette Wright. Who's, okay. So he's a very funny dude. DC, Maryland guy, nerd, whatever.
Yeah.
He said this thing that I've been saying to my dad for years, like ever since I've been able to like travel a little bit just around the country and just especially the tri-state area.
Yeah.
My dad would say something like, you know, oh, how's the town that you're in? And I was like, how's Poughkeepsie?
Right.
And I was like, it's fine. It just kind of reminds me of Waldorf. because Waldorf, Maryland, it's like, because I remember, so like maybe like 90 through 92, 93, I'm in junior high, I'm 12, 13 years old. And Waldorf, like, it had the St. Charles Town Center, and that mm-hmm. was, like, the mall. Like, that was,
yeah.
like, really, like, it's not going to be, it's not better than Tyson's Corner. Like, right. I think in the area, like, maybe Tyson's Corner was, at the time, was, like,
yeah.
the best mall in that.
Tyson's is always going to be kind of the height of malls in Maryland, I think.
Okay, yeah. And like,
or in the area, I know it's not in Maryland.
Exactly, okay, because we don't want the people that are from...
No, hey, the people... Yeah,
actually...
The Virginia contingent would be very upset by calling Tyson's Corner a Maryland mall.
Yeah, because it's like... Because I grew up in PG County, and then by the time when I started driving, and you wanted to go somewhere, like you wanted to go to a mall or get some sneakers or go to somewhere, we'd go to Pentagon City.
Pentagon City.
And like, I would take my mom to the mall, she'd go to Nordstrom's, we'd drive out there.
Yeah.
And you know, she could go shoe shopping, I would go walk around somewhere, and she'd get Cinnabon and I would get Mrs. Fields, and we whatever. You know,
what was your Mrs. Fields order? Cookie did you
just
like?
Chocolate chip. Just standard issue chocolate chip.
I liked their, they did butter cookies, which are some of my favorite. It's just butter. It's like a shortbread butter yeah. cookie. They were so good. I used to love those.
They're not around anymore.
I know.
They're just, I think
they're still like at, did the company fold?
I mean, they're still, I think they're still selling those cookies. Like you can
but
get
them.
But
they're not like at the mall as a standalone.
Right.
Ugh, I remember going to those all the time when I was younger.
And we're diverging a little, but I don't care.
Yes, we are.
But I don't give a shit. They're not paying.
I love Mrs. Field. She's important to talk about.
Yeah, there was like this. There's some. I think it's near Radio City. I think it's somewhere in Midtown. Like, you know how they have those little, I guess, they, what do you call them? Those subway, shopping center type places?
Yes, in the concourse.
Yeah, they had a Mrs. Fields there. I don't know if it's still there. But
I gotta go figure this out after we finish.
Okay, you let me know, because
I'm gonna do the research and I will report back.
Because at one point, I think maybe I had a spot somewhere, I was doing a podcast or something, and I was like, oh my god, Mrs. Fields. So I bought a few cookies.
Yeah, you have to.
It's the shit. And so I don't know. There was a mall in Syracuse that I thought had it, but I think they're closed. But anyway. So you're thinking like at that time before I could drive, my dad would take me down. We'd go to Waldorf and we'd go to the mall. There was like there was two different malls. There was like the St. Charles Town Center, and then there was mm-hmm. a strip mall.
Right.
That had like this, you could get video games, or you could trade in your games, all that shit. And then it started to be this sprawl. Now they have every store you can imagine there. And that's become, anywhere USA to me. Like, yes. It used to be the country. Now they've built it up. There's some places that are kind of incorporated or whatever, and they...
Yeah.
Everybody's there. And Lafayette said this maybe two or three... He said it last month, and he was like, I forget what it was. But he was basically saying, like, everywhere is Waldorf.
It's so true.
And I just, like...
I get that.
It's like singing my life with your words, dude. That's, like, that's... It really is. So that's what I would compare, like, most places. Like, oh, you have a... There's a Starbucks. There's an Applebee's. Yeah. There's a Target.
We've reduced to so few. I feel like even there's fewer regional chains than mm-hmm. there used to be.
Yeah.
Which used to be a real, like, you know, demarcate, like...
Yes, yeah.
What's the... Jimmy John's. Like, we didn't have that in Maryland.
No.
When I was growing up. But now I think that there's, like, Jimmy John's in every city.
Okay, now I've got to ask you this since you mentioned mm-hmm. it. Now, you grew up... Did you grow up in Annapolis?
Yeah, like, just outside of Annapolis.
Saverna Park, okay,
yeah.
Okay. So... I didn't realize this until I moved back east, which was like 07. And I used to, mm-hmm. you know, go, you know, visit my parents up and down 95, all that crap. Sheetz. Did you like Sheetz? Did you have it growing up?
We didn't really have it where I was, but uh-huh. I had friends who would live in different areas of Maryland who yeah. did have it.
Okay.
And now it's a bigger thing.
It is, I think, because...
I think so.
I went to Mount... You went to Princeton. No. Did you go to Princeton? Harvard.
Cornell.
Okay. One of those Ivy League schools.
One of them.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. So I went to Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, Maryland, which is...
Yes. My friend who went to Mount St. Mary's was the one who talked about Sheetz nonstop, because there was one close to the campus, I think, right?
Yes. So maybe you'll tell after we're done, you'll tell me her name. So yeah. Maybe we went at the same time. I don't know.
Very possible.
So that was, yeah. And that was in Thurmont. And
yeah.
That place, when the cafeteria food wasn't good, or we would go to Sheetz and it was incredible.
Yeah.
And now I feel like it's not the same. It's still pretty good, but like I would always go with like the roasted, like the grilled chicken sandwich, and you, like it would be amazing.
Right.
Maybe it was that Sheetz, and then the one like in like Joppa Town.
Right.
It's pretty good. Like, but like, it's just like not, I don't know. It's not the same anymore.
Right.
But there's,
and some of it could have been like where you were in life and how you felt about going and eating there.
That's true.
When you're just stopping because it's there.
Yeah.
It's so hard because there are like, you know, I can't put my finger on any now, but even just like chains or snack foods that I just remember from being young and being excited to get, and then going and being like, oh, this wasn't really as good.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's over time that it has gotten less good in production. And maybe I'm older and my tastes are a little bit different now, or this is a context in which I'm not as excited to get it.
Yeah, well, sometimes I make, like, I did a, the last time I was in that area, it was Easter, and I was coming from, near Cornell, a casino gig in New York. Yes.
One up there.
And then you go, and I went back through Pennsylvania, and I did stop at a Sheetz, and it was good.
Yeah.
It was fine. I know there's always been this schism between Sheetz and Wawa. I just wanted to see if you had a take on that.
We didn't really have either near my house until I was like into high school, and then there was a Wawa, but like because it was like from Philly, I was like, no thanks. You know? Also, like, we have, like, good local subs at a place called Gino's that I would go every day. So.
And see, that's the thing. Like, I think that's something, like, where I grew up in PG County, you kind of did rely on chains a little more. And it's where, like, some people piss me off on Twitter where they're like, oh, Pizza Hut is trash. Little Caesars is trash. Domino's is trash.
Not everybody lives in like Manhattan.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, because it's people. Like, it's definitely because I working in Westchester, working with people from New York proper, the city, all these different places. You lived around that stuff, so yeah, you wouldn't go to Pizza Hut,
right? But if you didn't have other options for pizza, and it was frozen pizza or Domino's, like you're getting Domino's.
Yeah,
and that's good.
And then, I mean, we had Shakey's, but I don't think you probably had.
Yeah.
Did you have Shakey's at all?
I know it, but we didn't. It wasn't something I grew up with.
Oh my God, it was great. It was like, because that was it was a chain. It is a chain. It still exists, not in my neighborhood in my childhood neighborhood, but it's like. It still had a hometown vibe. Okay, anyway, let's not talk about what God. So Severna, Well, this is just going to be a long episode.
That's fine.
We'll wrap it up.
Yeah.
So Severna Park, what was that like? What did your parents do?
We lived in Severna Park, I think, because my mom taught in Baltimore County in Pikesville. She was a middle school teacher when I was in middle school, and then when I went to high school, she started teaching high school, and then she's been teaching high school ever since and just retired this year, which is crazy.
Oh, wow.
So she taught for 40 years.
Jesus.
Which is absolutely crazy to me. And then my dad worked in, you know, he worked for Kodak and then for Canon in kind of like a sales or marketing capacity that I still don't really know. But he did a lot of government contracting, so he worked in D.C. And Severna Park is pretty comfortably between those two cities without having to, like, go far, west or whatever. And it's like a lovely little community. It's a small, you know, it's a small town outside of Annapolis, which is a small city that's barely a city. It's mostly just like a waterfront and a mall.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was very, very, very suburban. But it's like this weird thing because, like, you know, my dad worked in D.C. My mom worked in Baltimore. Baltimore's super, super liberal. Like, we're super liberal. My dad's from, New York. My mom's from New Jersey.
Gotcha.
And, like, we moved down there. You know, they had lived in Baltimore in the 70s, the two of them. And I'm like, that must have been the most fun because it just seems like they just talk about it like it was the greatest time in their lives. Okay. And I'm like, not when you're
you.
Yeah. Before my mom said to me when she was like, the best time of your life is when you're married and you don't have kids. And I was like, I'm your only child.
Wow. Okay. That's what I was about to ask you. So you're an only child.
I'm an only child. Severna Park was. It was a beautiful place to grow up. I have zero desire to ever spend a second there at this point in my life.
Oh, shit. What? Now, what did you say was your mall? Did you say Annapolis Mall was your mall?
Annapolis Mall. But then, like, if my mom and I wanted to do something more serious, you know, we'd go up to Towson Town Center in Baltimore.
Okay, okay.
Which was a nice mall. And then during the Jewish holidays, we would take the day off of school and go down to Tyson's. And that was like the big drive down to Tyson's. So we went to all the malls.
That's cool. Yeah, because I thought like Annapolis is good. I think that's a good mall.
Yeah, it's a nice mall.
I remember taking a date to the Fuddruckers out there.
Oh, yeah. It's like off in a separate parking lot from the mall, but it's across the street. And I've been to that Fuddruckers many times.
Oh, my God. That's my favorite. I was there last week. Not at that one last weekend, but I love that place.
I used to love their fries. I remember. They were super salty and big, like, wedgy potatoes.
Yeah.
Severna Park was nice, and it was cool to be, like, so close to downtown Annapolis, which is just
beautiful.
One of the most beautiful places. Like, as much as I have hatred for the deeply conservative, narrow-minded nightmares that can live there, it is, like, to me, the prettiest place on earth. And I was a rower in high school. So like I was out on the river every day. We were rowing by kind of all the docks and the streams and the Naval Academy and the bridges. And that was like my every day. So it was really, you know, nice to have that and to be so close to that and have the opportunity to have that.
Right.
There were probably, I could count on one hand, the Jews in my school, and we had a school of 2,000 people. And it was, you know, like, it, I mean, like, and maybe there were more than I knew about, and, you know, but at least in my grade, I remember I knew who the other Jewish kids were. They were all friends of mine. you know, it was a very white, very blonde. I joke about it on stage a lot. Where I'm like, it was like going to school with 1,000 golden retrievers that believed in Jesus. Like, it was just just a lot of Caitlins and Ryans.
Oh,
and
shit. That's hilarious.
You know that, like, central Maryland, that real... Like, when I think of Maryland, I really think of Severna Park, and it's everyone plays lacrosse, and everybody drove the same Ford Explorer, and,
yeah,
you know, all perfectly nice people. I have no personal issues with anybody, but it's just not a place that I ever really felt comfortable. But then when I was rowing, I rowed in Annapolis for a rowing club, because our high school obviously didn't have a team. That would be insane. So there were girls from high schools all around the county. So, like, I had friends who went to school downtown at St. Mary's, the Catholic school, and then Annapolis High School, Broadneck High School, Old Mill, because, you know, there was just like, this is the rowing club. So if you want to row, you all come row here. So it was like nice to have like that, because like then all of the like-minded, I want to be in a boat and be, you know, those people, we all found each other. And those are actually still very close friendships for me in a way that like most of my high school ones are not.
Now, did your high school, was that public or private?
Public.
Okay. Was that Severna Park High?
Yeah, Severna Park High School. And then there were like two other private schools in the area, but my parents were always like, I think it's this a better education.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, you know what? I always thought that, like, because I went through Catholic school from preschool to 12. I thought sometimes the public schools might have had better resources.
Just because, like,
I remember, at least for the one,
you know, I live near Severn School, and it's a very tiny private school with a ton of money. But, like, if you only have 100 kids per class, per grade maximum, you're not going to offer as many classes because you don't have, whereas, like, there were 2,000 people in my high school. You know, there were 500 kids in every class. So, like, there were a lot more AP classes, a lot more electives, a lot more.
Yeah.
Because they had so many students that there would just be more breadths of interest.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting that
schools had way more money. Like, yeah. That's not a lie.
We were in the break room this afternoon, and I was talking to some coworkers. They were talking about, what is it? Is it Rosh Hashanah that's Monday? What's Monday?
Oh God, I forget. Yeah, I think it's Rosh Hashanah.
They were saying something about how we were just talking, and I was like when people would be off, when the students would be out of school and stuff like that. And I said, I was thinking, I was like, yeah, we never really, I didn't have, when you talked about the disparity of like Jewish kids as opposed to like, I guess, other just white people.
I don't know what the other really. I don't know the difference between the Christianities.
What do you say, Anglo?
Yeah, just like I was always like the Christian kids.
Okay, the Christian kids are just the white folks. Because we didn't really have that many, and then I was around Catholic school, so I didn't know that many Jewish people until I moved to Skokie, Illinois, which is predominantly like a Jewish area.
I worked
for the Skokie Park District, and I worked in the school system, and I taught theater. My listeners know that, but you don't. But I worked in that area as predominantly Jewish. And then public schools, you know, even they had like, well, these kids, you know, they're going to be off for this high holiday, blah, blah, blah. And there was an awareness. And then obviously being in the New York area,
they're basically regular holidays here.
Exactly. So
everyone's off for Roche.
Yeah, because I had a buddy in grad school that was like, hey, Chris, you know I'm Jewish, right? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, this isn't school ties. You're not Brendan Fraser. Like, it's all good. We can all learn together.
Yeah, just figure it out and we can know.
Yeah, it's like it's not a big deal to me. But yeah, like that's when I was like, oh, and then there's bagels and there's the cool shit that people have. Because if you're not around it, you're not gonna know. And then that's right. like what we were talking about earlier, like getting to know people that are different from you.
Yeah, I think it's what makes everything better. I'm so much happier that I know so many different kinds of people living, you know, in New York versus when I grew up. I just really just knew it, I felt like everybody was the same and I didn't really fit in with them.
Mm-hmm.
Which was very specific. You know, I think that Severna Park was a very specific homogenous group.
Yeah.
But I know that that's kind of what happens in a lot of these kind of suburbs around, you know, especially the Mid-Atlantic, but probably around the country. And it's, you know, if you're growing up as like a Jewish kid who's like a little weirder and sillier and you know, I had friends. I had plenty of friends in high school and I did well in high school and have, you know.
Obviously you went to Cornell.
And I enjoyed it. Yeah. I enjoyed it. And I don't have like a terrible like nightmare version of my high school, but like every time I go back to Severna Park and go back to Maryland, I'm a little like, oof, I don't like being here. I'm not comfortable here. It's a little spooky. I don't know. When everybody looks the same, it's scary.
What do your parents say about that?
I think they get it. You know, they like it there in as much as like, it's absolutely beautiful and mm-hmm. They have a house that they've lived in, you know, it's the house that I grew up in,
right.
You know, they're still in it and they really like it and they like their, you know, our neighborhood was very close and I think that they have a nice life there. But I think that even politically, I think that they are just like, we are outnumbered in a way that is really scary and it's really weird.
Yeah.
It's just a very conservative area and it's just kind of not who our family is, but
sure.
Our family also is like, three people who have been able to just like have a good time wherever we go. So I think that they're
right.
They get why I'm not like eager to like, they know I'm never going to move back or like that. I'm not going to, you know, plan long trips at a time to just spend in Severna Park. But yeah. You know, I think they wish I would come home more and I want to come home more just to spend time with them.
Yeah. I need to do more of that.
Yeah. It's so close. And the nice thing about Maryland is you can just hop on the train and it's right there. It's 3 hours. You're in Baltimore and, you know, I got to do it, but it's not my favorite place on earth.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I feel some kind of way about like, I don't know when I go back, because it's changed a lot. Like Prince George's County has like just kind of evolved into Waldorf in a lot of ways. One thing is a good that my parents are older and they can go to places that are close and stuff like that. But like, yeah, like it's becoming... I mean, it's becoming even more congested. And I think the older I get, the more that I kind of feel like wanting to retreat into certain things. Because like the same way you feel about Severna Park is the way I have an interesting way, like thing about like small town America, how I'm just discovering that I really like it.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much it likes me being
being
black. Like, it's not like, it's because I'm black and the way that I feel, these people always fucking look. It's not like, it's that, but it's not. It's just kind of like that awareness that you have where it's like, I'm different. I get it. And I would like to partake in this as a law-abiding citizen.
Yeah.
But it's just like, I kind of like the fact that, oh... You can go into town and get the newspaper or whatever it is, or like, when I was a kid, like staying with my grandmother, my dad's mom in the summertime, like, we would go into town to go to the strip mall.
Right.
And go to the arcade or go to Kmart to get a toy.
Mini golf was a big one.
Oh my god, so I don't know, there's like this, I just kind of feel conflicted. Like I like
it's
how
complicated, you know. I think especially like if you live in and around like a very big city and you're from a smaller place, it's kind of a, you know, it's always going to be a little complicated because, you know, that is always going to be home. It is always going to feel vaguely nostalgic, even if I, you know, resent elements of it and don't want to, you know, and don't want to like be there for the rest of my life. Like,
of course,
there is always the moment when like I'm home and my parents and we drive into downtown Annapolis to go get oysters and shrimp cocktail and beers at yeah. the bar where I've been going since I was younger than 21, you know, like, you know, there is something like very, I'm just like, ooh, I do love this, but yeah. I also feel like that I've been building, you know, that life for me, like here in Brooklyn and with all of my close friends and
sure.
in the industry and my other, just like my New York friends who I've known for, you know, 15 years now, you know, that there, I'm like, you know, it is kind of nice to like that and then know that like, but I kind of have that right now. And mm-hmm. if I had a kid who was experiencing this, like this would be how they would feel about it. So.
Yeah. And then like you, the way that you're framing it, it's almost about, it's partly about the company that you keep anyway, you know, like yeah. your friends that are around you. Like I could care less about the bar that I'm in. If I'm right. with my friends, it's going to be a good time.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, I'll always like love and hate Maryland in like a very complicated way.
Sure. Yeah.
But like, also I know that like growing up there and having the experience I had is probably a little bit why I do what I do and why I have the comedic voice that I do and that why I think about the world the way I do, which has created stand up that people like and gets me jobs that I want. So,
right. And you know, why you're successful. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a, you know, it's a tricky one, but
that's true. Like I was talking to, I don't know. Do you know Brandon Collins?
Yes.
I was talking to him. We were talking about this movie, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. And we're mm-hmm. talking about like how, I don't know, like there's like this love hate thing that you have with a city or the place that you're from. Mm-hmm. And it's like you have to love it to hate it in a certain way. Like, yeah. and I think like that's one of the closing scenes of the, oh, it's a scene in the third act of the movie, but it was just like, and then in one of my favorite movies that I always talk about all the time, Medicine for Melancholy, where like Wyatt Cenac is talking about San Francisco, and it's a movie about a man and a woman. It's the aftermath of a one night stand where the couple tries to get to know each other after they have the one night stand.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And it's on the backdrop of San Francisco, the city, you know, the one of those movies where it's like the city right. is a character,
right?
Before Sunrise, Before Sunset type thing. Barry Jenkins's first movie.
Oh,
so like I love it. Now my listeners, if they were to write in, they say, Chris, it's not all that, but for me, that's his best one. Anyway.
No, I'll have to watch it.
Yeah, I think if you do, you know, shoot me a text, let me know what you think.
I will.
But so like it's kind of like that thing where it's like you have this love for it and nobody else better talk shit about it. But if right. you're an outsider, but, you know, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. If people say Maryland sucks and they're not from Maryland, I'm like, well, you don't get to have that opinion.
Exactly.
You have to know why it sucks.
Yes.
And like have lived through it sucking.
Yes. Right. And that's
which I think is true of everyone's home and everybody feels that way about where they're from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's, because I even say, and it's shitty, but it's real to say, like, Maryland is a place where if I didn't have any dreams, I would still be there.
Yeah.
And then I would loosen that punch by saying, in the arts.
Right.
Because it could be somewhere. I feel like an asshole, but if I say it to like my friend, a person like you, another sure. creative, like you, and you're from there, so you know.
Yeah,
but it's like,
I mean, everybody knows that like you can't really be a successful actor in Maryland. You can't be a television writer in Maryland. You know, it's just
yeah.
you could be in New York or LA, and like that's kind of like the choice you have to make, and
yeah,
it sucks. You could start a company in Maryland. You could become an artist. You know, there's so many great things you could do, but the entertainment industry has really chosen its two cities, and that's all that you really get.
Yeah. And it's sort of like the where, I don't know, like I thought I had something poignant to say. It's yeah. Like, cause okay. Case in point, I can look at a lot of the people that I went to high school with that are on Facebook they still live there. They're fucking killing it. They have kids. They have a wife or a husband that they're unhappy with. They're doing it the right way. You know what I mean? They're doing it. And it's like, they're fine. And Maryland, like, it's, you know, and it's great.
Yeah.
I never had the desire. When I was young, I was never like, I got to get the fuck out of this town. I got to get the fuck out of this place where my parents take care of me and they put me through school and they pay all the bills.
Right.
I got to get the fuck out of here, bro. We're going to get the fuck out of here where all this love is at. Even though they argue something. Yeah, where it's comfortable and like go somewhere else and try to fucking say lines that somebody else wrote. You know what I mean? Like to try to be an entertainer. So I was never like that. So I think that's why it's always like, I think that's why I always have like a, that I've never really like shitted on
the
area. And then at the same time, I could see how you feel about Severna Park.
Severna Park's pretty specific, so.
Yeah. Well, what's going on with you? What do you got going on? What can we plug?
You know, I always like a Twitter or an Instagram follow at Allison Leiby. I have my storytelling show is the second Saturday of every month at Subculture. Saturdays at 11:30. And then every Sunday I host If You Build It at 9:30, same venue. Great time. Real fun. You're going to be on one of the shows soon. So
yes, please do.
You know, and other than that, just kind of bopping around doing stand up and picking up little jobs for the rest of the year. So no big projects forthcoming right now, but hopefully cross your fingers sometime soon.
Yes. Maisel season 3. No official
Maisel season 3. Watch that in December.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it for me.
Well, Allison, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line after I wrap this up. And
no problem.
And this, you've been a delight. Everything that I thought it would be. And more.
This was terrific.
Yeah, this was fun.
I had such a great time.
This was great. And so everybody, thanks so much for listening to the show. I'll talk to you next time. Listen, subscribe, all that stuff, Patreon, and we will talk to you next time. Take it easy.